I'm Scott McEwen, co-author of American Sniper and Ghost Sniper, and you're watching Mr. Media.
I'm Bob Andelman, and this is a Mr. Media interview. You can see, hear, and read more than 1,000 of my previous celebrity interviews at MrMedia.com. That's MrMedia.com. Subscribe to the show on YouTube, iTunes, Apple News, Google Play, or Stitcher, and please follow us on Twitter and Facebook. On today's show, I'll welcome attorney-turned-writer Scott McEwen. He's perhaps best known as the co-author of the number one New York Times bestseller, American Sniper, which he wrote with Chris Kyle. Today, McEwen is here to talk about his latest Sniper Elite fiction series, Ghost Sniper. Stick around. First shot is a warning, right, Scott?
No warning shots. No warnings.
Uh-oh. There is a rogue American-trained sniper tearing up the Mexican countryside, and, more importantly, the country's political landscape, in Scott McEwen's latest Sniper Elite novel, Ghost Sniper. On the surface, hell, the cover illustration is a close-up of an enhanced sniper rifle. You might expect that this will be a story that glorifies horrific gun violence. And while the violence is brutal, it isn't celebrated at all. The fast-moving story is one of good versus evil and many shades of dirty gray, all of them leading back to the CIA. If you like tales of international espionage and psychological warfare, it's hard to beat the power of Ghost Sniper. As for Scott McEwen, who's joining me today, he is a San Diego trial attorney who made his name in books as the late Chris Kyle's co-author on the number one New York Times bestseller American Sniper, the autobiography of the most lethal sniper in U.S. military history. Now, you may also have seen the film version of American Sniper, which starred Bradley Cooper as Kyle and was directed by Clint Eastwood. And there might have been an Academy Award involved in there somewhere. Incidentally, a feature film based on Sniper Elite is currently in the works. And with that, Scott McEwen, welcome to Mr. Media.
Thanks for having me on.
Great to have you here. how does a trial attorney prepare for a day of thinking as a sniper? I mean, I switching from what I do, I wouldn't begin to know where to start.
Well, you know, before I was a trial attorney, I grew up in Eastern Oregon, Bob, and where I grew up was an area near the Idaho border, and my brothers and I used to hunt all the time. I mean, we were shooting or hunting or fishing basically every day, four-wheel driving, and so I grew to know weapons and rifles very, very well as a result of that experience. And the area where I grew up is kind of the starts of the High Plains Desert, if you will, the Great Basin, before you hit the Rocky Mountains. So there's a lot of open area on top of the mountains that between timber stands, which makes for very, very long shots. And I grew to get pretty good at long shots, and then started experimenting with calibers of weapons that are now routinely used for hunting and even in the military, but then weren't so routine, such as the 300 Winchester Magnum, which is my favorite gun of choice. Come to find out, when I got to know Chris Kyle later on in life, many, many years after I became a lawyer and started writing, 300 Winchester Magnum was his favorite round as well. And so we had something in common with that round, because it's a very flat shooting, very strong, high powered round that doesn't have a lot of weight to it. And the significance of that to a sniper is very important, particularly one that might have to be out and carrying his goods for hours in 110 degree heat and have a limited amount of ammunition that you can carry with you.
When you were out there in the woods on the mountain, did you ever dream that this is what you'd be doing for a living between the law and writing books about snipers?
No, you know, I certainly not. I mean, I've always been. My father was a pilot in World War II. I was not in the military, although I was accepted to the Air Force Academy and did not go. I ended up going to Oregon State undergrad instead, but. I did not believe or have any understanding that I would ultimately find myself friends with and then writing the stories of Chris Kyle. But I did believe that someday I would be writing stories or telling stories about patriots, because growing up with my father's generation, my father was older. He passed away about 10 years ago. But his generation from World War II made me inspired to be very, very patriotic. I mean, that generation of American, you know, instills that love of country, that love of military, that love of, you know, of your fellow man in you. And my dad was certainly one of those people.
How did you get into writing?
You know, I got into it just through, I mean, as a lawyer, you have to write a lot. And I found myself as a lawyer trying to creatively write sometimes, particularly when you have, you know, I was a corporate lawyer, so many times your fact patterns were pretty boring or whatever else. But I always like to throw an interesting spin in, particularly when I was writing for the appellate court or something like that, because you know you got three or four justices or clerks sitting back there just reading the same, you know, rigmarole every day, boring. Black and white, law, cite the law, cite the facts, the law, this kind of stuff. But I always like to put a spin on it. And I was very successful at it. You know, I mean, as far as even the justices would cite the language that I used many times in their opinions to say, this is a very interesting way of explaining the law, you know, in a very down to earth, real manner that people can hold on to. Because ultimately, a trial lawyer, which is what I did, is nothing more than a storyteller. And the question is how you tell your story.
You don't know this, but I make my living as a writer, and I'm always telling young people exactly that, that, yeah, you can write, and you can just write the same nonsense over and over again, or you can make it memorable, and people will remember that you've turned a phrase, you did something that made it stand out, and especially, you know, in a situation where you're being read by people who read briefs all day long. You want to stand out. You want them to remember
you have
something.
To. Yeah, you have to, or it's just another day. You know, they don't take your case, particularly in writs. I found that writing writs is very, very important because that first paragraph of a writ, which is basically a legal document that says, put my case in front of all these other appellate cases. You got to take mine right now, Your Honor. Something is on fire in front of you. You got to really compel your reader to say, uh-oh, hold on, wait a minute. If this guy is what he's telling is the truth, this is some outrageous stuff I'm about to read. And that is really kind of the key, I think, to also writing creatively is you want to make your reader want to turn the page.
Mm-hmm. Well, you definitely did that to me in Ghost Sniper. I told you off air that I generally, when I get to the end of these fiction books, I stop at a certain point, so I can't give away the ending. And we had to delay 24 hours finishing this interview for technical reasons. It's killing me because I want to know how the damn thing ends. So I got to tell people that you know, you may think a sniper novel. Why would I want to read a sniper novel? I'm telling you, it moves really well. It's a lot of it's very tense, a lot of adventure. There's people you care about. Would your high school English teachers have ever predicted that Scott McEwen would be a writer one day?
You know, I don't. I laugh about that because I remember in high school English. In fact, I was just thinking the other day of my high school English teacher, and they made us memorize. Or my high school English teacher was kind of a older lady, and a lot of people didn't like her because she was, quote, considered to be over the hill. I personally liked her a lot. And she was kind of a Shakespeare file, if you will. And I will never forget the poem from Merchant of Venice and the mercy speech that was given in that play, because I felt that was such a compelling, you know, piece, you know, just to say the quality of mercy speech that they gave in that play. I thought it was like brilliant, you know, brilliant even back then. So I think that I appreciated, you know, good writing back then. While I didn't understand it, maybe I certainly appreciated a good tale, and a tale told by a classic writer, even Shakespeare, I really enjoyed when I was in high school.
Country music fans may get a bad rap that they don't read enough, that they don't know enough about the history of country music. Well, maybe it's a matter of reading. Maybe you'd rather listen. I mean, you listen to music, right? So maybe you'd like to listen to a book about country music stars. You know, Audible has been a sponsor of Mr. Media on and off for most of the 10 years that we've been around. And maybe you'd like to check out an Audible book on tape, right? Listen to it. Don't worry about reading it. But so I went and looked to see what was available. How about Outlaw, Waylon, Willie, Chris, and the Renegades of Nashville? That's by Michael Streisguth. That sounds good. How about The Tao of Willie, A Guide to the Happiness in Your Heart by Willie Nelson and Turk Pipkin? How about The Man Called Cash, The Life, Love, and Faith of an American Legend That's by Steve Turner. And that one's narrated, get this, by Kris Kristofferson, himself a legend of country music. Well, you can get a free audiobook with a 30-day trial today by signing up at www.audible.com/trynow. All right, one more time. Mr. Media listeners, you can get a free audiobook with a 30-day trial today by signing up at www.audible.com/trynow. That's T-R-Y-N-O-W. Now, so you explained a little bit about how your interest in rifles came about and sharpshooting, that kind of thing. But one of the things that's interesting about this particular book, and I'm guessing others in the series, is that it takes place in a lot of exotic places. I mean, it's Switzerland and China and Mexico, D.C. This stuff always fascinates me because interviewing a lot of novelists, I'm always curious to know how they get their detail. I mean, have you been to these places? Are you really good at dispensing details from online?
One of my favorite hobbies, and I should say that probably my favorite hobby is to travel. And I, you know, when I was in college, I attended college in Europe, and I also lived in Europe before I went to law school and worked in London. I actually did some work for a member of parliament in London. So I traveled a lot in Europe while I was there, and I've been to Mexico I live in San Diego, so Mexico is literally a stone's throw away. But so I've been down there many, many times, and this book was kind of an amalgamation between myself and my co-author, because my co-author lives in Mexico, Jim Kalaniar. And so we both wanted to kind of collaborate and bring in different aspects of each of our experiences with this one to kind of put the character in that world. If you look in the series, and I think, Bob, like most series you ever read, you've had the opportunity to read this one, but I would suggest to yourself and obviously to the readers, and not so much for the purposes of sales of books, it's really not that. It's more like to say that this character of Gil Shannon and his cohorts really begin in book one. And in book one kind of sets the ground stage, if you will, for these guys and for how they operate, their senses of humor, their sense of justice, and their justice sense is much different than your average person's, because they literally, you know, have the decisions between life and death at their fingertips, and they make the call on what it is. And when you're dealing with situations like these, you know, I used to have guys, and I have guys tell me all the time in the spec ops world, and that is, if I'm going to work on an operation, I'd rather work in black op than I would on regular op. And I used to ask them, well, why is that? And their response was, there are no rules of engagement. Mm. Nobody, you don't file reports on this type of stuff. This is your rules of engagement are exactly what you set them at. So it's a different set of rules, if you will, than the average military guy has to deal with, you know, in engaging an enemy, which I many times disagree with the rules of engagement, because I think that they're so much slanted towards the terrorists as opposed to our military. But that being said, you know, many times in this world of black operations, there are no rules, mm-hmm. other than what you set yourself.
Well, I was going to say, certainly in the book, you get the sense that there are no rules. Certainly the people in the book, the people who are supposedly the good guys, they're not following any rules at all.
That's right. Because they know that they're dealing with guys that don't follow the rules. So you either get in the same level playing field, or it's many times a fatal mistake.
Except that they I don't want to give away too much here. They don't follow the rules even when they're dealing with their own people.
No, yeah. Well, that's the other thing too, is the characters that are created here, particularly, you know, Crosswhite and Shannon, you know, they are both Medal of Honor winners, and they're both like very highly decorated men within the spec ops world. And so as a result of that, it brought them notoriety, but it also brought them a certain sense of entitlement. I should say the belief that they are special. And so that's one of the things I like to write into the characters, is what you do with that belief and how you limit or use that belief to help you complete your mission for your nation, and many times for your teammates.
So how does a guy from Oregon, like yourself, who's living in San Diego, and your partner, who's living in Mexico, name a character Rhett?
Yeah, well, you know, A lot of times it's kind of funny because some of the guys we come up with, you know, are from experiences that you've had in life. And then other times you just basically, you know, see things and make decisions, you know, out of for whatever reason. I don't find the names of the characters to be as important as the characters of what they are. In other words, you got to give them some singular, you know, some individuality, I should say. But that being said, for me, the actual naming of the characters is almost irrelevant. You know what I mean? It's kind of like one of those things where you could call them, you know, whatever you'd like, as long as you stay consistent within your script.
I just thought when I saw the guy was named Rhett Hancock for the record. I just thought this guy's not going to be a good guy. I mean, who names a character Red anymore? And I thought it's got to be a bad thing. But also, you mentioned Gil Shannon, and it's interesting. I am where I am in the book. I'm not going to give anything away, but Gil Shannon has really not been much of a character in this book. Yeah. It's mostly been the Crosswhite story and Vought. It's interesting that. So what you're saying is, and I went back and reread the press release that came with the book. Shannon is the hero of the series, but in this particular book, he's kind of MIA for quite a bit.
Yeah, Gil is going through something in his life that's kind of a crossroads because in the beginning of these books, he's with his wife. And now he's kind of lost his way. Now, where the character goes in the next installment to the series is kind of like, you know, you always build your character and your characters have to, at the end of a story, have to have something that they've changed and somewhere that they've gone in their development or whatever else. So Gil is really, I think, in the next book going to move back towards the homestead, if you will. But I haven't really decided yet. It's one of those things where, you know, men go through these things and, you know, and his wife said to him, and as I'm not giving away anything in the book, look, when you're ready to stop chasing bad guys all over the world, then I'm ready to be with you. But until you're ready, I can't live this life anymore. I can't live off a telephone call not knowing whether you're going to live or die. And it's really, and that's a reality in the world especially guys that do private work for the Central Intelligence Agency. It's very dangerous. It's very lonely. And keeping a relationship together while you're in that world is really very, very difficult.
Speaking of the CIA, I expect to see, and again, I haven't finished the book, so I don't know where it's going or what's going to happen next time, but I expect to see Crosswhite high up in the CIA eventually, trying to turn that organization around. That's my expectation.
Well, you know, Crosswhite, the thing about him is you got guys like Bob Pope that make executive decisions and have more the big picture, and then you got the Crosswhites of the world that, as they said in one of the James Bond installations, are many times the blunt instrument of the decisions. You know, the one that actually goes out and takes the shot or does whatever is necessary. So both are absolutely imperative in any world of an intelligence agency, and you know, sometimes they can move in between. Gil has certainly moved more towards the headshed, if you will, but Crosswhite is still an operator.
Yeah, I get that. But Pope does not seem like he's got a lot of history, not a lot of future left in government from where I'm reading right now, anyway.
Well, Pope started out in book one.
Yeah.
And Bob's been there the whole time.
Right, and it's good. And I should point out to people that, I jumped in on the fourth book. I didn't even know there were three other books until I was halfway through this one. But it's interesting because I'm sure I will enjoy reading the first three books, but you don't have to have read those three books to know what's going on in this book.
Right. That's the tough part about a series is all must stand alone, but each must build on what's come before.
Right. Yeah. And it does that really well. I mean, I don't feel like I realize every character in every book, whether it's part of a series or a standalone, has a history. Here, I feel like I have enough of the history to grasp kind of what's going on, but I'm curious enough to go back.
Right.
So
good.
That. Would you say then, to go back to what I was going to ask you, would you say that in writing about international locations and things, have you been to most of the places? I mean, have you been to China, for example? Have you been to Switzerland?
Yeah, I've been to basically every place in this book. And I spent a lot of time in Switzerland, actually, skiing and also traveling through there. Love that country. It's beautiful. And Mexico, the final scene that I won't go over yet, but my decision was whether it was going to take place in the town where it did or in the main square of Mexico City, where the beautiful grand church is there, where they actually filmed the last James Bond movie. The opening scene was in that same square right there by chance, because I've always thought that that was such a photogenic place and such a great place to have a sniper duel. In the future, there might be one there anyway, but there's like major, like hundreds of yards and a huge square between each other. And it would be a great avenue to have a sniper duel right in the middle of it.
You know, it just occurred to me as you were talking about that, that another parallel, I think, from your book would be with the, might be with the series 24, the Kiefer Sutherland series, in that there were always – and the difference is you hint in the in this book, Ghost Sniper, in the fourth book of the series, about suitcase nuclear weapons that were brought into the country and things. And in 24, they had a nuclear bomb go off outside of Los Angeles – which you would think that would tie them up for at least the whole 24 hours dealing with that, and they never reference it again. There's never reference again to it. Also, in your book, you have in this story, there's an earthquake in Mexico City, and you're dealing with that throughout the book because it becomes a player, and I'm sure it'll factor in later. But
Mexico City is famous for its earthquakes. I mean, you know, one of the things that it's like as common as L.A., in fact, more common than L.A. to have earthquakes there. They've got some serious faults in that town. It's built on a volcano, too. So, but yeah, I mean, I like to create, as does Jim, as much chaos as you can and then find clarity within the chaos, because ultimately the guys that these operators, what they're good at is being able to focus even when the world around them crumbles. And even when it becomes so complex, they still have to focus in on either the shot or getting the bad guy or whatever it is their mission is. And that's one of the things that I find very interesting about these type of special operators, is their ability to focus even when your average person would think everything in life is chaos. Hmm.
You mentioned your partner again on this, Jim. How do you guys divide up the work? Who does what, and how do you resolve things?
You know, sometimes we do it by chapter and throw them back and forth. Sometimes we do it by characters coming in. We always discuss the plot line that goes on with the characters. The original three books, particularly the first and the second, were already directly in my mind as far as where I wanted to go with the SEAL Team 6 operator, Gil Shannon, the lead character in this series. And some of the operations that Gil did in the first book and the second book are taken directly from special operations missions.
But when you start one of these books, does one of you start writing and send it to the next one and you write it back and forth? Or does one of you take like the whole through line of one particular plot aspect? Or how do you do that?
Generally, it's chapter driven. Just put chapters back and forth for different things that we're doing. And we'll just send them back and forth to each other. And you know, one of the things that Jim is very good at that I get bogged down in is dialogue amongst the characters. So his script writing, if you will, is really good, you know, as far as the dialogue and the banter between the characters, whereas mine is more of an overall, here's the mission, here's the goal, here's how you set it up, here's the weaponry, here's the, logistics, here's the airplanes, the trains, the automobiles, whatever else. So it's kind of like, I think I do more of the thought process as far as the overall picture of where we're going with the operations, and Jim does a lot more of the dialogue.
And how did you guys find each other? How did you start working together?
We both have the same agent in New York.
Oh.
Ian Cleaner at Objective Entertainment. Great guy.
Nice. Very nice.
Yeah. Yeah, Jim wrote a book that I really liked called Cannibal Rain. And it's kind of a end of the world kind of thing, hence the name Cannibal Rain, where people are actually eating each other because the food supply is gone. The earth gets – it's a post-apocalyptic dystopian world of a meteor hits the world and everybody's basically fighting to survive. you know, in the proverbial nuclear winter for 2 years, where there's no light whatsoever that comes through the clouds, essentially the event that killed the dinosaurs, or at least what people contend to be historically the event. But he wrote a book about that, and it just struck me as some of the scenes in there were so, let's just say, base, that human, you know, depravity that Jim can describe, he can go anywhere he wants. And so I really was impressed with his ability to write characters that had really come to the most basic level of human existence. And so that's kind of the friendship that him and I started was from there.
At the same time, do you make sure that you're never left in a room alone with him? Because, you know, reading, hearing that kind of stuff would make me go, yeah, I don't want to be alone with this guy.
Well, I tell you, in the second
if he gets that hungry look in his eye, I'm out of here.
Well, in the second book, by interestingly enough, and this is a funny story because our editor in New York was definitely a little freaked out. But in the second book, we have a scene where the nuclear weapon that is involved in that book that is in play in the United States has been smuggled in a drug tunnel. And the drug tunnel, this is in Target America, book two of the Sniper Elite series. The drug tunnel is operated by a drug lord in Mexico. So the drug lord in Mexico realizes that his tunnel was used. One nuclear bomb has already gone off. The second one is in play in the United States. Martial law has been declared. And he realizes that he has just been elevated from a drug lord that's protected by his own government many times with bribes in Mexico to a international nuclear terrorist that's going to be hunted down like a dog and killed like one, you know, whenever the CIA and the FBI and the NSA and everybody else can get a beat on him, they're going to take the shot. And so he realizes that's what it is. And he is interrogating the guy that took the bomb through his tunnel but didn't tell him what he was transporting. And let me tell you something. That interrogation is – I had it a certain way. When Jim was done with it, it will make you cringe when you read the interrogation. That's all I can say.
Yeah.
Because, they, you know, like these Islamo-terrorists say that they won't talk. You know, and there's an interesting statement that I heard from somebody that – a friend of mine in the SEALs that was one of the interrogators, and he says – everybody talks. It's just a matter of when.
Yeah. 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 I think I'd pass on that scene. I don't mind the action stuff. I don't mind, you know.
But no, I know. I mean, you know, you have to have a certain level of, I don't know what it is, darkness that to be able to write some of that stuff. And Jim can go there more dark than me. That's all I can say.
Yeah. Sometimes it's just a bridge too far. I actually was going to have somebody on the show in the last month, and I had gotten about a quarter of the way through the book, and I thought, yeah, okay, I'll let's do this. And then I got halfway through it, and I thought, you know what? This is just – it's dark, and it's not well-written, and it's just –
No, you can't concentrate on it, and you got to give – that's one of the reasons I like to do a staccato pace and chapters that are short, is even when you're going to something that's very – you know, makes you feel squeamish, even the most average person makes you feel squeamish, get it done. Get out of it. Move on to your next theme. They can't be a theme of your work.
Leave a little bit to the imagination.
Exactly.
Yeah.
In my opinion, I agree with you.
Let me ask you one more thing about Sniper Elite, and then I want to ask you about Chris Kyle. So I understand that there is a movie in the script writing process. Is that where it's at?
It is, and the script is looking very, very good. It's Sheldon Turner wrote the script. Sheldon's a good guy. He's got at least one, possibly two Academy Award nominations. He's an A-list writer from Los Angeles, and he has got the script just about to the point where I think it's finished, and I really, really like it. It's an amalgamation of the first two books, One Way Trip and Target America. And it's been acquired by Sony Columbia Pictures, and the producer on the project is a guy by the name of Kevin Mischer, and Kevin was the guy at Universal, ex-president, that was responsible for the creation of the Jason Bourne series and several other huge series there. And the guy's like, he's really bright. He understands this world really well, and I'm really excited to see if Sony picks this up because, you know, we got enough material to keep going, and obviously every fiction writer's dream is to be in a situation where you've got a very active you know, well accepted, you know, big lead role in, you know, in that type of stuff. And, you know, that's, I don't know, for me as a writer, if you can get a James Bond or a Jason Bourne or a, you know, that kind of a character to be multi-generational, then, you know, it works out pretty well.
Do you have a fix in your mind on where and when you become strictly a writer and walk away from the law?
I'm pretty much done with the law.
Oh, you really?
Yeah. I don't do it much anymore at all.
Oh, okay.
Right. Yeah, I mean, I still have my license, but I don't do it much.
So you can't help me with this parking ticket thing, right?
No, I don't do it. Like I said, you're going to have to get the right guy to do it, and I'm not the right guy.
To be honest, the only reason I did the interview was hoping you could help me with a little
traffic
court stuff.
I just... In Florida, traffic.
Yeah.
No less.
Yeah, you know. Okay, well, all right, the interview's over. No, so tell me about Chris Kyle. How did you first connect with Chris?
As I said, Chris and I had a mutual interest in 300 Winchester Magnum. Most of Chris's shots were taken with a 300 Win Mag. So that was kind of when we got together, I socialized quite a bit and still do with a lot of Navy SEALs that live in this area of San Diego where I live, the eastern part of the county. And I met Chris through another friend of mine who was an ex-Navy SEAL, another buddy of mine, and just got to know him and really got to know his story in detail just over a beer and barbecue or whatever. And, you know, after I'd heard so many amazing, you know, stories from Chris and from his fellow operators in, you know, mostly in Team 3 Charlie, I just said to Chris, I said, you know, your story is really historical. And, you know, I think it's something that deserves to be accurately recorded and accurately written down, because it's really kind of the story of the battles that we've kind of fought since 9/11, 2001, you know, in the sandbox and in Iraq and in Afghanistan and in related areas. And, you know, I just said, you know, I think you should really consider doing it as a book. And one thing led to another. We started recording a lot of the operations that he did in a written format, or I should say just recorded them. And then ultimately I did a presentation and a treatment, and one thing led to another, and we've sold it to HarperCollins.
Very good. And there were a couple people involved with that book besides the two of you, right?
Yeah, there was Jim DeFelice I worked with out of New York. After we'd had the project was sold and ready to go and pretty much most of the raw material was done, a decision was made to go from third person, because Chris didn't want to take too much personal credit, to an autobiography first person. I was then still an active duty lawyer, in fact, starting a trial. And so I was faced with the proposition of rewriting and basically going from third person to first person in an entire 400-page manuscript, which is quite an undertaking. So a decision was made to retain him to work on that. And, you know, that's the way that how that happened. Hmm.
It must have been pretty exciting when the book was sold to movies.
It was very exciting. I mean, it was the book did extremely well. I mean, obviously, and that helps people start calling when that happens. There was a lot of different interests in Hollywood, and I was fielding that area. I mean, at the time, it was all very new to both Chris and I, although I'd had some experience in the legal world in Los Angeles for some time when I practiced up there. We were approached first by 20th Century Fox and by the people at the House Productions, which is obviously a hugely successful series. Katie Jacobs and her group. Ultimately, they wanted to do an episodic version of the American Sniper. We negotiated that for some time. Things didn't work out the way everybody wanted, and I was then approached by Warner Brothers and by Andrew Lazar's group, Mad Chance at Warner Brothers. Was introduced to their group and to Jason Hall, who ultimately wrote the script. And Jason had met Chris, and I felt, after having interviewed him for a number of times, that he really had the feel for the character that we needed. And for Chris's character, I think he understood him well, as you reflected in his Academy Award nomination. But I think that was the right choice, and one thing led to another.
Now, Chris is no longer with us. I'm kind of assuming here that anyone who's made it this far in the interview has an interest, is aware of that. But what do you want? How do you want Chris to be remembered? How do you remember Chris?
You know, it's kind of weird because one of my most vivid memories of Chris is just how humble a guy he really was, and how much he loved to joke around and, you know, and you know, kind of just shoot the breeze with people. And he was just a normal guy. I mean, he was a very intense, obviously, warrior, but one of the funnest guys I ever drank with in my life. So I really miss his personality and his sense of humor, because he really had that kind of Texas smile and that drawl, and he really liked a good joke, you know. So Chris was a great guy. And, you know, my most vivid memory of Chris is kind of reflected at the end of American Sniper, when he was killed. And the memory was not so much of him individually, but of hundreds of thousands of people on the freeway between Dallas and Austin, Texas, on a windy February, rainy, ugly day that no one should have been out. And there was hundreds of thousands of people lining the freeway for over 100 miles. And every bridge on an overpass had a huge American flag with the local fire departments. They shut the freeway down. I mean, you know, you're talking about shutting down a freeway the size of the I-5 between here and Los Angeles. And the governor just said, you know what? The freeway's shut. And there's very few places in America, let alone the world, that you could shut down a thoroughfare between two major cities, an interstate, and just say, you know what? I just shut it down. And that's Texas. And people just came out, stood in the road on both sides of the freeway for 100 miles and in the driving rainstorm. And I tell you, it was most patriotic, respectful, unbelievably, you know, amazing thing that I think I've ever seen in my life. And probably, I mean, I was with a guy that I wrote a book with, Rich Miniter, who's a pretty famous guy, wrote a book called, you know, Leading from Behind on Obama. And I wrote a book called Eyes on Target with him as well. But Rich was with me, and Rich just looked at me and he said, dude, I don't know if you realize it, but that book had a big effect. I mean, you know, that book had a big effect. Sure. When you see something like this, this kind of an outlay of pure, you know, passion, pure emotion by that many people, you've really, you know, created something that is very rare. And, you know, and I didn't really appreciate exactly what he was saying until that happened. And the final scene of American Sniper, which shows a funeral procession, kind of captures that. So your audience can see that, because that's all from iPhones, including my iPhone. That was the view that I had during that time.
Hmm. Well, let's before I let you go, I want to talk a little bit about your writing room. I'm assuming you're sitting in a room where you do a lot of writing.
I am. This is my office in San Diego, and this is where I kind of I do a lot of work.
Do you have to have anything particular to sit down and be comfortable? Coffee, soda?
You know, it depends on what time of day. My best stuff is done, Bob. I think I'm kind of an early riser, so I'm up early and 6 a.m., 5:30 a.m. kind of thing. I go to bed early, but I'm up and rolling before the rest of the world kind of is nagging at you, you know, kids and dogs and whatever else. And so I find that just the ability to sit and be in a quiet place, I don't care where that place is probably of paramount importance to me.
Mm. And, you know, anything in the room there that has particular meaning for you? Since we have the video, I like to, you know, pry into people's lives a little bit.
You know, I have, it's kind of funny. Behind me, I have kind of a library, and I've actually been cleaning some stuff, so I've got like some different stuff back here. There's obviously some boxes with t-shirts, some of my Sniper Elite t-shirts, things of that nature. But my library here, it's kind of interesting. I've got a lot of different versions of American Sniper there. It's now published in 25 plus languages. And so you have all these different versions of the book, and you got to look in the front page to see actually where it's published, what city, to actually even know what languages it is many times, because the difference between Czech and Polish escapes me, you know, as far as my ability to know the difference of, you know, whether it was, you know, in Czechoslovakia or whether it's, you know, Czecho, you know, whatever the language is, you know, and especially, you know, even in the Chinese and all of your Asian languages, between Chinese, Japanese, and, you know, any of your other languages there, it's very difficult for me to interpret.
I get that. I have a book, economics book I did, was published in several European and Eastern European countries. I've got the one, I think it's from Poland, but yeah. I can't tell. And the one I got the most kick out of, though, was I did a book with the founders of the Home Depot, and for some reason it was purchased and it was published in Japan. And it's really cool to see the cover. There's the two of them. Everything is in Japanese, except down at the bottom it says, with Bob Andel. Like,
Is that
because I'll get a kick out of seeing my name, or because there's no pronunciation in Japanese for Bob Andelman?
I don't think they have the way those little letters go across, whatever, the markings. But I see you're a Captain America fan by the stuff behind you there.
Oh, Bob. Yeah. Yeah. Well, for what it's worth, it's Captain America, but it's right below Sid Vicious from Sid and Nancy. So,
there you go.
I try to have some balance.
You know what? I just saw that first Captain America movie. I think it was the first one in that series.
Yeah.
And my son said to me, my 12-year-old, he said, you know, Dad, these are really well done. And I was like, okay, whatever. You know, another Spider-Man, another Batman, whatever movie. You know, another one of your, you know, codpiece and mask movies. But I tell you what. They're really well done. I mean, they're really well produced, really well directed. The CGI is almost flawless. You know, they put a lot of money into those Captain America movies. I was really amazed, actually, when I saw.
Now, they're really good. They're as a lifelong Marvel Comics reader, I you know, they started doing them, and I was just like, oh yeah. Like the first, this is off track, but the first one was the Iron Man movie, and it was just like, Iron Man's like second rate, but it's like, wow, you really found a way to make me believe Iron Man could exist.
No, man, they do an amazing job, you know, and I'm not a big fan of that genre. I mean, I was, you know, I kind of like some of the old comics. I used to read them, but I was never a big, like, you know, I wouldn't go to a Spider-Man movie when the next one comes out or whatever, you know, that kind of a thing, you know, but I really felt like those movies, that series of movies were really well done, you know, technically, as well as, you know, the personalities were compelling and, you know, and you know, I felt the whole thing was really, really kind of professionally produced.
I tell you what, if you like the first one, having read your book now, yeah, I think you'll like the second Captain America even more. It's got a real Iron Curtain kind of twist to it.
That's what I've heard.
Yeah,
I've heard the same thing. So I'm definitely going to watch it.
Yeah, check that out. So what's next? This was book four in the series. It sounds like there'll be another one.
Yeah, I think there will be. We're in the process of negotiating that right now. As you might expect, the future of a book like that is many times becomes, let's just say, more interesting to the publishers and to everybody else if, in fact, the series is turned into a movie. You know, and so you know, you're kind of at that stage where you're in the impasse between, you know, that they're in production. Or I should say, they're in development, but when they put it into production and it's actually made and made well, it kind of changes the whole thing as far as value is concerned, you know. And you know, we're kind of in that at that stage of production or level of the next book. You know, unfortunately, guys like Stan Lee, who are unbelievably talented and unbelievably, you know, creative in their character development and their thoughts and everything else, weren't able to take advantage of that given the way that their comics were done so many years ago, you know. And now, you know, I look at him as someone that in awe, actually, of all of the characters he developed, all of the storylines, all of the amazing stuff that guy did to really have no financial benefit of it, or very little, you know, by the end of his life.
Well, he's done pretty well. I mean,
has he?
Oh yeah, he's got executive producer credit on every Marvel movie. He gets a piece of everything.
Well, good. I'm glad he deserves it. I didn't realize that. I heard that he hadn't done that well, but I'm glad to hear that he has. I didn't know it personally, but you know, I find it really the creativity side of me says that those guys should do well. You know,
some of the other guys. I mean, he ran Marvel, so he was in a position to make sure that he was taken care of. Some of those other guys, Jack Kirby and Steve Ditko, those guys haven't fared quite as well. But I think Stan's gotten kind of like the Mafia. He's gotten a little taste of everything, you know?
Well, good. I'm glad to hear that. Yeah. I really am because he deserves it.
By the way, you should – well, if you're going to go see some Marvel movies, go see Deadpool.
I did.
Oh, you did? Okay. Well,
brilliant.
And I was just thinking –
And it was the spin that was taken on that character. I don't know if it was written that way because I never read the Deadpool comics, but the spin kind of that, you know, that third person looking in saying, you know, do you expect this to be another one of the Marvel movies, you know, whatever, or another just, you know, I love that kind of deadpan, you know, take the piss out of yourself kind of viewpoint.
Now that's straight out of the comics, but also
it is
the way the comics are written, but also the Stan Lee cameo in there is spectacular.
Yeah.
I won't say what it is in case people haven't seen it, but it's the best.
Yeah.
All right. Well, listen, folks, you can find writer Scott McEwen's Sniper Elite novels, including the latest, Ghost Sniper, in great bookstores everywhere, or you can order them right now at a great price at MrMedia.com. You probably know how this works, but if you're watching on video at MrMedia.com, just below the video, you'll see the cover of the book. You can click on it right now. You can download it as an ebook or get it shipped to you, maybe via drone, I don't know, in 30 minutes or less. I can't promise that, but maybe, let's say within a day or two. You can order it there. All of his books are available through that link. Scott, website, Twitter, Facebook, can people find you online?
Yeah, scottmcewen.com is my website. I'm on Facebook at Scott McEwen, author. I do have something on Instagram, I think, but I don't even know what it is, or Twitter. I mean, I don't go there very often, and I really don't have the time to post a lot, you know, in that world. But I understand it's a lot of people do, but it's kind of not my bailiwick. And then if you're interested in nonfiction, I have another book coming out in September. That is called American Commander, that is certainly not a sequel to, but it is a follow-up on the same genre as American Sniper, written on a individual by the name of Ryan Zinke, who is a SEAL Team 6 commander and is now the sole congressman from Montana. Amazing guy. And it kind of goes from the viewpoint of an officer, how do we create the SEAL team guys that we want to carry that burden for the United States and to do that job, and really a fascinating look at what it is from an administrative level and from an officer level on how you choose the guys that really become the tip of the spear for defense of the United States. And I think people, if they enjoyed American Sniper, they're going to really like American Commander.
Very good. Good to know it's coming. Maybe you want to come back and talk to us about that in September.
I'd love to.
All right. Well, Scott McEwen, pleasure to meet you. Enjoying your book. Now I got to get off the interview so I can go finish the last 50 pages so I know what happens. Thank you so much for joining us on Mr. Media today.
Well, write me and tell me what you think of the ending.
I will do that.
All right. Thanks a lot, Bob. Thank you.
Media is recorded live before a studio audience full of unsuspecting target practice dummies. Oh, wait, was that supposed to be a secret? Oh, well. In the new media capital of the world, St. Petersburg, Florida. That's my disarming people with my personality.
No problem.
And in the case of a sniper book, I think disarming is very important at this point.
It is. Got to get people relaxed before you shoot them.
That's exactly what I was thinking.